Blog Talk Radio.
Hello! Hello, everybody! Welcome! Welcome! Thank you so much for being here. I'm your host, Golden Hawk. This is another reality show. It is Thursday night, and it's a full moon. Yes, it is. It is a... it is very auspicious, actually. Tonight's the full moon. Yesterday was the equinox, the autumn equinox. And I think, when was the 22nd? 22nd was also yesterday. We had some solar flares. So it does appear that there's a lot of bodies in our celestial bodies that are kind of, you know, moving and putting themselves in a place where some very, very powerful shifts can be experienced in our space. Because remember, everybody, all the planetary bodies are really symbolic of us. That which is on the outside exists within our beings. So this really is quite an auspicious time to be on planet Earth in this dimension and in this frequency. I've also been seeing sevens, like all night I've been seeing sevens. Phil, I'm going to ask you actually about that once we get the show started. Okay, but in the meantime, let's all shut our eyes for a minute. Of course, if you're not driving, take a nice deep breath. Shucks, let's take a few nice deep breaths. They're free. And let's intend that our essence join us in our physical beings, in our bodies, in the awareness of where we are right now, grounded, stable, conscious beings in this dimension on this planet. You know, this is really all about inviting our essence in right here, not leaving our bodies to experience our souls, but actually inviting our souls in to the body to experience our souls in this dimension. This really is very, very powerful intention. I've been doing it for the last few months, and it is shifting my reality in the sense of, I'll give you the perfect example. I left my cell phone on top of my car today while I was picking up Sahana from school. And once I realized that I had done that, I actually looked out to see if it was still up there, and of course it wasn't. I had already driven about 3 miles. Anyways, as I was going through the day, because this is the first cell phone that I've ever owned, and I realized that, you know, losing it is one thing. You definitely get a sense of, oh my God, you know, my connection. That was the first thing I thought. My connection has been lost. And I quickly had an intuitive hit going, my connection can never be lost. The technology that I'm using to be connected might not be there, but my connection itself can never be lost. And then what I also realized is I was listening to some things, some MP3s, while Sahana was at ballet and taking a nap. And I realized that there's a lot of anxiety on the planet. I mean, of course I know this. There's a lot of anxiety on the planet right now. But because I have been inviting my essence in, and I don't just do this on Thursday nights. I invite my essence in every single day, several times a day. Anytime I'm just kind of sitting there with nothing to think about, I'm like, oh, okay, let's invite it in again. And it is absolutely reducing my anxiety and my stress that, you know, I know people would truly... you know, literally freak out losing their cell phone. I mean, I have a lot of information I have, you know, that I've never written down anyplace else. I have phone numbers that I talk to people. But the truth is, it's gone. There's nothing I can do about it. I can take some nice deep breaths. I went to the Verizon place. I turned off the number so nobody can call Japan through my phone. you know, and life goes on. It is really, it's a very simple experience when, you know, I'm giving it the meaning that, you know, perhaps I was getting a little carried away with the, getting on the Facebook and texting and stuff. So this is really a moment to just bring me back to the original thought that my voice, or the original message that the voice within me gave me, which is that I'm always connected. So I wanted to share that with everybody. Of course, as we do our meditation of inviting our essence in, I highly, highly recommend everyone to do it. It's, like I said, it's free, and it really does change everything. It's not that bad things won't happen. You just respond to those bad things in a much more joyful way. So thank you for joining me on that. And tonight I have a longtime friend, a master storyteller, and a pretty amazing guy, Phil Imbrogno, is on the show tonight with us. Welcome to the show, Phil.
Am I on?
You're on, babe.
Oh, okay. I'm good.
You good?
I'm good.
Yeah, I know you are. You're a grounded human being. For somebody who's been looking at the stars all your life, you're a very grounded person.
Yeah, well, that's how you get your foundation, by extending your mind out to the vast cosmos.
Right, but staying grounded physically, right? I mean, that really is an important aspect, yeah.
You have to stay grounded physically when you project outward.
Well, you don't have to. Don't you know? I mean, I know lots of light workers, quote unquote, they're literally leaving their bodies. They're intending it.
Well, the body's still staying where it is, isn't it?
Right. Well, but it's almost like it's vacant.
Yeah, but it can't be vacant. You got to have that connection.
Yes, indeed. So you've been very busy lately. I haven't seen so much of you this summer. I know you've been busy with lots of wonderful things happening for you.
I have a book coming out in December.
Okay.
Called Ultraterrestrial Contacts, Paranormal Investigators, Explorations or Investigations of the Abduction Phenomenon. And I have a book coming out in March called The Vengeful Djinn. And let's see, I've got a book coming out with Rosemary, The Vengeful Djinn, and I got a book coming out that I'm just finishing. It's called Portals, Doorways to Another Dimension, The Search for the Origin of Paranormal Phenomena. Mm-hmm. And I just signed a contract to do Files from the Edge 2. Which is a continuation of my book, Files from the Edge 1, which is out now, came out in April.
Yep.
I've been a busy boy.
Yeah. Wait, and didn't you also go back to MIT to get your PhD?
Well, that too, but that's secondary.
Well, I know. I'm very proud of you. Not that what I feel matters, but I was very proud of you because I knew just from your own heart.
Just don't call me Dr. Phil.
No, because I know you personally, that won't exit my mouth. That's funny, though. Dr. Paranormal, maybe, but not Dr. Phil. Congratulations on that, Phil. I know that was very important to you. I'm happy for you.
It just took me twice as long as everybody else.
It doesn't matter how long it takes. It's about the completion. Rock and roll, babe.
Yeah, well, I did it for myself, not for professionally,
exactly.
Not for ego. Anyway, yeah, people say, oh, yeah, you got your PhD, but you're getting ready to retire from teaching. I said, yeah, you know, it's a personal thing rather than something to throw around a title.
Exactly. Which is all about that grounded part of who you are. It's just, I think everything in life should be done for self. And then whatever the benefits are, okay, so be it. But when it's done for self, you can never fail, no matter what it is going on, because it's about self, not ego.
Yeah, well, another thing, I'm going to be interviewed by the New York Times.
Oh, wow. When's that happening?
Well, they're doing a story on me.
Oh, wow. What? Really? Mm-hmm. I mean, I get that it's paranormal, but what section would you be in?
Psycho section.
What, under Bellevue?
Obituary. I think it's going to be coming out in one of the Sunday editions in what they call the culture section.
Oh, nice.
And it's based on, you know, evidently it's reached some places, all the work I've done on the stone chambers and the fact that there is a lost America out there.
Okay.
And that it's focused on that, you know.
Nice. That is your passion. That's a beautiful thing. That's beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you never, like I said, you never know who's listening. And finally, you know, people say, you know, gee, you know, I mean, there's so much that took place before Columbus, and especially in the Northeast, that, you know, there has to be, you know, they have to mean all something. And the idea that there is a lost America out there, I think, is beginning to take hold of a lot of different people in a lot of different places, indicating that what we think of history is wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, it was clearly written by one factor. And, you know, there's many, many other factors that never got their, you know, their day in the sun, so to speak. You know, the truth about what, you know, I mean, just starting with the chambers. I mean, but I do believe people are realizing as they awaken in consciousness that much of what we've been taught, quote-unquote, historically has, you know, been including, quote-unquote, the big historical one, the Bible. You know, it's all taking on new meaning because we're becoming aware of self, you know, more of self. That's what the whole meditation is. I think that's what the whole experience of us being here is, just becoming more and more aware of who we really are and then taking it from there.
Yeah, well, yeah, I guess that's true. And there's just so much information that's coming out now in this particular time period that people are becoming more aware and more open to it, you know, despite all the troubles in the world. So, you know, there's something on the horizon that's going to emerge into a new consciousness. And when that happens, human beings on this tiny little planet will have a much broader understanding of not the universe, but the multiverse.
Mm. Definitely. Definitely. I believe it's already happening. I mean, you know, it starts off as pockets, and then inevitably it will lead into groups and communities. You know, it's...
Yeah. Well, you know... Getting around changing the subject here.
Please take us where you want to go.
Well, you know, I've been practically all around the world and investigating and researching paranormal phenomena and, you know, getting involved with paranormal research. And, you know, I'm just starting to talk about it now. You know, in Files from the Edge, you know, it's the first time I'm publishing some of this material from these adventures that I've been on from different parts of the world. And the book, The Vengeful Djinn, I give my experiences in the Middle East. Would you like to hear the story?
Of course you are the storyteller, please.
First of all, you know, back then, this was like in the mid-1990s. And, you know, today there's a lot of interest in the idea of the djinn, just like the stone chambers, by the way, which, you know, I introduced to a lot of people in the early 1980s. You know, that has become a popular topic now, and people are taking off on it, which I like. That was the whole purpose of the thing. Now, you know, I introduced the idea of a dimensional being that's been interacting with the human race since recorded history, that the Islamic and the Muslim people call the djinn. The word djinn means hidden, because according to, you know, the ancient beliefs and the Persian beliefs, these creatures were invisible. Today, that means to us that these beings are in a close-by dimension, an area that we can't see, but it's very possible that they can see us. Now, you know, when we take into account the jinn and these dimensional beings, we can in fact start to explain a lot of paranormal phenomenon. And, you know, I've been talking about the jinn on Coast to Coast Radio and a few other stations. People have been asking me. I've been getting emails about it. People are eager for the book to come out to see how I incorporate the jinn into modern society. And I co-authored that book with Rosemary Guiley, and she took her knowledge of fairies and leprechauns and the ancient tales and some of the legends of Solomon and so on, and merged it all together with the information that I was able to obtain in the field in the Middle East. So it kind of married really well together to present the Western world the truth about this being called the jinn. Now, according to legend, they were the first race on this planet. They were here before human beings. And what happened is that they became very powerful. They developed technology. They started polluting the planet. They started to make war with each other, and they were in danger of extermination. And to stop this, according to the legend, Allah, God, sent an army of angels, higher order beings. You don't have to consider them angels with wings or so on, but angels that we call angels could be a higher order of developed being, photonic in nature in the universe. They stopped the jinn from destroying each other and polluting the entire section of the galaxy and universe, and so they wouldn't do any more harm to themselves. They isolated them in a nearby world, and where they were supposed to stay, and guarded by a very, very powerful angel, very powerful being. Now, of course, then Allah says, you know, God says, I have a new creation I'm going to put on planet Earth, and I'm going to call this creation Adam, you know, mankind, the human race.
Okay.
And he said to the angels, I want you to serve this being, bow before him. And all the angels bowed and says, yes, you know, we're going to do this. And he said to the jinn, bow before Adam. And the leader of the jinn, the head honcho, the most powerful of all the jinn, who was ascended almost to the power of an angel, and the other jinn who were ascended, the angel said, no, we're not bowing to this creature. We're older. We're made of the most beautiful of fire. And this creature you made out of the mud and the clay, which is, you know, matter.
Right, right.
Why should we bow to them? And according to the legend, Allah said, go to hell. And the jinn were cast out into this other dimension. But not all the jinns, not all the jinn are evil, but these jinn. But according to the legend, Iblis, who was the leader of this renegade jinn, before he was cast out of this, you know, and put into like a horrible state, which within Christianity would be called hell, he said to God, creator of the universe, you know, whatever you want to call this being.
Right.
Okay, I can prove to you that this creature that you made is not worthy. Give me the power to, and allow me to interact with them to show you how easy they could be corrupted. And God said, okay, you can do that. But those who say that they have given themselves to me, which is, you know, God's people,
okay,
you cannot touch. And Iblis said, okay, deal. So according to the Islamic belief, Iblis now, you know, is on the earth and corrupting the human race to prove to the angelic society and Allah, God, that they're not worth saving, and that the jinn should retake the earth because they've learned their lesson, and that humans are no better because they're on the brink of destroying themselves and polluting the planet. Now,
okay.
The interesting correlation here is this. Now, in Christianity, the role of Iblis is replaced by Lucifer.
Okay.
And in Christianity, it was not jinn who defied God and was cast out of paradise, heaven. They were renegade angels.
Right.
But in Islam, the devil, so to speak, is a jinn, not an angel. See, in Islam, they believe that angels are uncorruptible because they're made of the purest light. So they can't be corrupted. But jinn can because they have free will, just like human beings. Now, when humans took over the planet, I mean, this is like an interesting history thing, but it's like any other religious book. You have to take, read through the lines to find out what the heck was really going on. Now,
indeed.
Now, according to a lot of the Persian legends and the Middle Eastern stories and legends around the world,
mm-hmm.
the jinn lived with human beings on planet Earth for a while. The angels allowed a certain number of jinn to stay in our dimension and help heal the Earth and teach the human race and guide them. And they agreed to do this.
Okay.
And after a while, however, they became very resentful because they were told that whatever humans wanted, you had to do. This is where it came to the fact that, you know, the genie gives you three wishes or whatever and serves the human who releases them.
And that's funny. When you talked about isolating the jinn, the first thing that came to mind was, oh, is that the legend of the being in the bottle, the magical being corked in the bottle? That
well,
was where I went to.
Yeah, according to the legend, you see, Solomon, King Solomon, had control over all the jinn. And he was given control over all the jinn, and he forced them into slave labor to build his temple. Because these were magical beings. These beings have incredible power. But he had
okay.
control over them. Now, beings who became renegade, he imprisoned in iron bottles with iron around them, in iron containers, and in rings that there were certain types of jewels, crystalline in structure. Now, you see, and now many of these jinn are still imprisoned today, and there's stories about them, you know, Aladdin's lamp, the thief of Baghdad, and so on. The jinn
right.
shows up
right.
over and over again. And however, before the fall, some jinn, after they were discarded by the angels, according to the legend, some of them ran and hid, like in the very remote places, like in the mountains and so on, and they lie there very quiet because they're, you know, they're on the lam, so to speak. This angel society is still looking for them because they're very dangerous, and any human beings that come into that area, they try to scare away because they don't want to be discovered. This could account for a lot of areas in the world, especially in the United States, that have a lot of paranormal happenings that are said to be haunted. And in the Middle East, it's believed that they are the hiding place of a jinn. But getting back to Solomon now.
Okay.
Solomon was very powerful. And according to legend, he forced the jinn into slave labor, had enormous armies, was getting super powerful, was in God's favor, had jinn serving him. The kings around the area, including the king of Persia, the Persian Empire, and the Egyptian Empire, and Ethiopia, and so on, and the country of Sheba, they all became very concerned about this power. And they met to all unite together and attack Solomon and destroy him before he got too powerful. However,
okay.
you have to remember, all of these rulers were very ruthless. And, you know, not like, you know, presidents and stuff we have today that are somewhat bound by, you know, certain universal
human power. Rights and things
in
of that.
Beings yeah. who had the power of life and death.
Right,
over,
right.
Over yeah, everybody.
Anything,
so
yeah.
One of the rulers who was at the meeting was a woman by the name of Bellyquick, and she was, in history, she's known as the Queen of Sheba.
Okay.
Now, according to legend, the Queen of Sheba, her mother was a jinn, and her father was a human. And the marriage between a jinn and a human is forbidden in Islam, because according to the legend, the children are born sterile, and they're born sociopaths.
Oh,
and
wow.
Now, according to the story, you know, Sheba, she was like, you know, her mother, you know, left. She couldn't live with her father for very long because she was a jinn. And but her father raised the Queen of Sheba, Beliquik, and she was like, she was not even in line for the throne.
Okay.
According to legend, she murdered everybody. By the time she was 15 years old, she ascended to the power and became the ruler of Sheba by eliminating everyone in front of her, including her father, her brothers, her half-brothers, and everybody that was in line. She was so ruthless. Now, according to legend, you see, jinn have power over the mind of humans. We're in the fact that they can influence you. They can't control you and, you know, make you pick up a knife and stab somebody. But they can, like, they're like the little, you know, voice whispering in your ear that can influence you.
Right.
Now, according to legend, the Queen of Sheba had incredible power over the minds of men, in particular. Now, she convinced all of those rulers not to attack Solomon. And they just, like, gave in to her and say, yes, oh, my gosh, yes, you know, like they were so taken by her. They
right,
just listened
right.
to her, all these ruthless rulers. And so she went to go see Solomon, and her main purpose, she said, I can take care of him and stop it. Her main purpose was to go and corrupt him. And now Solomon's advisors said that, Majesty, she is the daughter of a jinn, and you can tell because her legs are hairy. So Solomon said he was so taken by her the first time he saw her when she came back to visit. You know, his advisors were telling him that she was the daughter of a jinn. She's out to corrupt you. She's evil and so on and so on. She'll destroy your empire. Don't do it. He says, nonsense. I'll prove that she's not a jinn. And his advisor said, well, all offspring of jinn, especially the females, have very hairy legs.
Wow.
So as she was coming, before she was coming to view Solomon, to see him, to come into his her hall, in his palace.
His presence, right.
Solomon had the floors of his castle, of his, you know,
stateroom, whatever.
Main audience hall.
Right, right.
He had them mirrored.
To look up the dress?
Yeah, but so it would look like it's wet. So when the Queen of Sheba came, she would have to lift up her skirt because they wore long skirts back then. She wouldn't want to get her
right.
So she would have to lift up her skirt, and he would be able to see if her legs were hairy from her feet, take off her shoes. So
tricky little guy, this Solomon.
As she came to Solomon's presence, she lifted up her legs, and he looked, and he was amazed to see that her legs were nice and smooth. And he said to his advisor, get out of here. You're all nutsos, you know. This is trying to get me away from the most beautiful, most desirable woman I've ever seen. But she was smart. You know what she did?
Well, I'm sorry. She picked up a Bic razor or whatever they had in the day, and she shaved.
She's Solomon. And then the whole story after that is that she corrupted him, and Solomon's empire fell apart, and he was lost in God's favor. And all the stuff there. So, you know, the jinn are historically in literature. But the interesting thing is this. In the Torah and in the Christian Bible, the building of Solomon's temple was done by human beings. In the Quran, the building of Solomon's temple was done by jinn. You see,
really?
That's the difference between the two beliefs.
Okay.
And Solomon was supposed to have the power of the jinn. But in the Christian Bible, the jinn are never mentioned. But devils and demons are mentioned. And according to Islam, the devils and demons are evil jinn, you see.
Right.
So, this is...
Well, isn't that just kind of a semantics thing? You know, meaning each one references them just using different names, no?
Well, that's true. But I'm talking about the fact that the idea, in Islam, they identify the jinn for what they are. But in Christianity, it's kind of like a gray area. Who are devils and demons?
Okay.
If you ask demonologists, people who claim to be demonologists today, if you ask them what is a demon, they can't tell you. They don't know. And some will say that demons are fallen angels. Some say they're evil human spirits. But, you know, in Islam, demons and devils are jinn.
Now, okay, I see. Okay.
The actual belief, the actual Persian belief, going back 2000 B.C. and 3000 B.C., is that they believed that there were three beings created by God. Human beings made out of physical matter, angels made out of light, and the jinn made out of smokeless fire. Now, according to their beliefs, that if anything that wasn't an angel and wasn't a human was considered a jinn, so things that we call fairies, leprechauns, and other, like, you know, minor fairy spirits and so on,
right,
would have been classified as jinn by the Persian priest 3,000, 4,000 years ago.
Okay.
So, you know, it's an interesting history. But, you know, back in the mid-19s, I had no interest in the jinn. I didn't even know heard the word jinn. I just heard the word genie. And when you talk about the word genie, I used to think about, genie coming out of the bottle. Yes, master, and so on and so on.
Exactly,
you know,
exactly.
Made me laugh, because our view of the jinn in the Western world is, I dream of genie.
Absolutely.
That's the closest correlation we have, and people laughed because Jeannie was ditzy, and, you know, and she was, you know, back then with the two-piece thing, and all the men used to watch the show just as, you know, so on and so
see
on.
See her bouncing around in that wonderful little outfit, even though I happen to be a fan of the show. Barbara Eden is a wonderful, I enjoy her essence. To this day, I still enjoy that show. I mean, but they definitely portrayed it as...
So
yeah, absolutely. Lighthearted, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Genies as, you know, Barbara Eden playing Genie and I Dream of Genie. And one
right.
of my favorite lines from the show is that Genie makes this big blunder. And Tony, you know, Larry Hagman, says, oh, Genie, don't worry about it. After all, you're only human. And she goes, oh, no, master, I am not human. I am jinn. And, she's an entirely different species, entirely different race. But one of the things that, you know, offended the people in Islam with that show, why that show would never be shown in Saudi Arabia, especially, or Iraq, or Oman, or one of the Arab countries there, is that in the later part of the series, Genie and Tony get married and have children.
Right, right.
And according to Islamic law, that's like, you know, absolutely, you know, blasphemy.
Never to be done.
Being would have children with a jinn, because the children would be totally crazy. And, in other words, the genes and the essence just doesn't mix right. It was not supposed
to. It's not compatible. Right. Wow.
So, you know, when I was in the Middle East in 1995, I was over in Israel, and I wasn't even studying the jinn. I never even knew. The only time I heard about the jinn was I Dream of Genie.
Right.
And so I was actually doing research on the Holy Grail. I was tracking the Holy Grail. I went from England, I went from Israel to France to England and so on, tracking down the Holy Grail.
I didn't know that, Phil. Oh, that's kind of interesting.
You don't know about me.
I have never stated that I have known you completely. That's interesting, though. Keep going.
As a matter of fact, just for a little information, I lectured about my research back then in 1995, searching for the Holy Grail and Knights Templar and what they found and so on and so on. And the book The Da Vinci Code came out in 2005. Yeah, most people don't know that I had conversations with Dan Brown before he wrote that book. I didn't even know who the guy was, but he was interviewing people who were doing research on the Holy Grail so that he could put this book together, and my name just popped up with a number of other authors who were doing research on historical aspects of the Grail and the true meaning of the Grail and so on and so on. Well, anyway, that's getting off the story, but that's another
adventure. It's okay. You plugged yourself, my friend. I love it.
That's another, adventure. But
indeed, and if you ever want to do a show on that, that's awesome. I'm totally open to that, so it's up to you.
Well, while in the Middle East, I kept on hearing stories about a race of beings called jinn, that they were, doing this, possessing people. Oh, no, it's a jinn. It's a jinn. You can't go over there. A jinn lives there. And I got interested. What the hell is a jinn?
Right.
And someone said to me, you Americans know them as genies. And I said, oh, genie. I began to think of Barbara Eden.
Right.
But the people over there took the idea of jinn very seriously. You know how some people in the United States are so scared of demons and the devil and so on and so forth?
Of course, that's their culture. Their culture is inbred in that,
they look
yeah.
at that as the jinn as being these beings that you respect and you stay away from because they don't exactly like humans. Some of them are curious of humans, it seems. Some of them are pretty harmless, but you don't want to take that chance that you're encountering a jinn who doesn't necessarily, like the human race. Now,
okay.
I got very intrigued in this. I said, wow, this is a whole new avenue to explore. So what I did is I wanted to go into Saudi Arabia. And to go from Israel to Saudi Arabia back then was very difficult. And because of, the customs and everything coming in from Israel, and it was...
The whole fighting, right? That's just about the two countries themselves, right? I mean...
Yeah, well, it's just very hard to go from Israel to one of the Arab countries. Anyway...
Yeah, yeah.
I had an associate in Saudi Arabia who I served with in the military. And I knew he was there, and I knew his position... And at the time, he was a colonel in the Saudi security force for the royal family.
Oh, wow!
So he was like in charge of security. So I
that's
call him.
That should be a pretty good open door for you.
He's an American. And he's American.
Okay.
He served in the military, and I have a military background. I served in.
Yeah.
Vietnam and so on and so on. I served in, special forces and all that crap there. But anyway, I sent him a telegram and I said, can you get me into Saudi Arabia without any problem? And I figured I'd never get a reply. So I'm in the hotel in Jerusalem, actually. And like in 12 hours, I get a reply to the telegram saying,
wow.
Come on in. Everything is set up, fly into Riyadh, and everything will be set up to show your passport. I said, wow, this is great. So, I come into, Riyadh, and I land at the airport, and I'm going through customs. And at that time, the king of Saudi Arabia had a heart attack, and people were afraid that the country, dissidents, were going to overthrow the country.
Mm.
And so... there's a little, turmoil going on in the country right now.
Right.
So I'm landing there, so I'm in line with the passport, right? So I'm figuring to myself, if Jack was part of the royal family and they got overthrown or there's something going on and somebody else is in power now, I could be in a lot of trouble because I'm coming in as his friend.
Right, right.
So I'm going. I'm in line at customs, and there's guards at people are at the customs things, and I come to the counter and I hand them my passport. Ask for my passport, and the person behind the desk looks at my passport, looks at my name. That goes on a computer terminal, looks at my passport again, looks at my picture, looks at me, and waves his hand, and two guards come. Two armed guards.
I'm assuming you didn't feel too good at that point.
No, I started to get very nervous, and he said, well, and they came, and they were, I don't speak Arabic, they were telling me, to go into this room.
Okay.
So I went into this waiting room, and I'm just sitting there, wondering if I'm going to be taken to a Saudi jail somewhere.
Exactly.
And I'm just sitting there, and nobody speaks English, so they can't tell me what's going on.
Right.
So after about an hour, 45 minutes, this Saudi officer walks in, a captain Yamneoshia Mokai or something. I call him Yar after that because we became good friends.
Oh, nice.
And,
okay. Did he speak English?
He came in, he spoke English.
Okay.
And he didn't say anything. He was cold. He looks at me and he said, he's talked in Arabic and they're pointing to me and he comes and he goes, come with me. And ask question. He goes, do not talk. So I said, oh my gosh. And I said, well, I know that the current government stood in line, but I said, what's going to happen here? I mean, Jack arranged for me to get in this country pretty fast. The telegraph came. I said to myself, we have a history. And I said to him,
right.
Oh, my gosh, I hope he forgot about those 3 days we spent in Bangkok. I thought he was still angry with something that we did that, I got him into a lot of, in a situation.
A lot goes through a person's mind when they don't know what's happening in a foreign country.
So,
I've never experienced it, but I can just imagine.
So
yeah.
What happened those 3 days in Bangkok, I can't get over on the air because you'd have to have an X-rated show. Anyway, it got Jack into a lot of trouble. And I'm saying to myself, oh, my gosh, he must have forgot about that by now. That was like 20, 25 years ago. So we walk outside, and there's a limo waiting. And I'm saying,
that's a good sign.
Back, and it's air conditioned because it's very hot there. It was like in December, but it was still pretty warm. And I'm saying to myself, I don't think I'm going to prison.
That limo was a definitely good sign. Yes.
Yeah, but I said to myself,
a truck with bars would have given it.
When nobody could tell me anything, because I
think
Jack always
right.
had a weird sense of humor. So I got one little bag, I'm in the limo, and I'm driving down, downtown away from the airport. I'm looking at the country. I mean, like everything, the houses and everything, is like a third world country. Everybody's poor and everything. And I'm passing, I must have passed about 30 gas stations in 5 minutes. And the price of gas then was 5 cents a gallon.
95?
5 cents a gallon.
In 1995, this is?
That's right.
Wow.
So we continued, and as we continued, all of a sudden, we started getting into like a little buffer between the slums, and all of a sudden these mansions started appearing, We're driving by these mansions, these estates. And it seemed to me at the time, and it was the time that there's two classes in that country, the very rich and the very poor.
It wasn't to America.
I mean,
right.
These houses and estates, would make Beverly Hills look like a slum.
Right.
It was that wealthy.
Yeah, it was that extreme. Right.
We came up to the, the palace area, the royal family, which is a big area that they have, a big compound, a big area with houses in them. I mean, like, everybody that's associated with the government lives in this one particular compound that's channeled off from the rest of the city. And it's enormous. It's an enormous place. I don't even know how big it was, but it was like a city within a city. Anyway, drive up through the gate, and the car gets out, it gets up, and my friend Jack's walking towards me, and he gives me a hug. And I'm saying,
that was the longest ride.
And he's telling me that, he said, I arrange we're going to have dinner tonight. And, there's going to be a black tie dinner. And you're invited. You're my guest. And the the son of the prince, and I'm not going to say his name, I don't care if I pronounce okay. his name, is going to be the host. And but, you know, he said, I have to go now because I have some pressing things, but you're going to be staying in the cottage over here, and I'm going to have a liaison with you, and he's going to secretary, and he's going to fill you in on what you should do and what you should not do.
Okay.
So I go into this, and they said dinner's at 8 o'clock. So I go into this, nice, beautiful villa, and I say, secretary is with me that they assigned to me, one of the secretaries, and he's Arabic. He's an Arab. He's a Saudi.
Okay.
And he speaks English quite well.
Okay.
Better
okay.
than some most people from Brooklyn speak English, but anyway. I said, all I have is this little bag. I don't have any clothes for a formal dinner. He goes, don't worry. He opens up this closet, and there's all of these suits and tuxedos and clothes like you wouldn't believe. And he says, they're all yours. For you.
Oh. They like you could take them with you when you left?
Yeah, but I couldn't. I was traveling all over the place. I couldn't fit them anywhere. And he said, they just bought them that when you were coming, and Colonel so-and-so arranged that all of those clothes be bought immediately for you. They're all brand new.
Wow.
So he said, I'm coming back, at a such and such a time. You can, freshen up. So I went on the bed and I fell asleep. And that's usually natural for me because I don't sleep well in strange places. Well, anyway, I slept. I was so exhausted. And all of a sudden, I just closed my eyes. And 3 hours later, the secretary comes to the door of the guy, and he said, and he let him in, and I answered the door, and he was angry with me because I wasn't ready for dinner.
Right.
And he says, you got to come now. He says, it is impolite for us to get there after the prince arrives.
Okay.
So here I am rushing, putting on a tux and everything, and he's filling me in what to do. He says, when you get there, he says, If you have there's going to be a social gathering. The prince will not arrive until he's introduced. He said, but if you have a drink in your hand or if you have a cigarette in your hand, he said,
right.
when the prince enters the room, you immediately put the drink down and put out the cigarette and face His Highness.
Okay.
And he said, then do not. I'm getting dressed all the time, trying to rush there and get for the prince so I don't get shot.
That's the last dinner you'll ever be late to.
I know. And he's saying, do not enter the dining room until you are called. Okay?
Okay.
When the prince enters the room, if you are sitting down, you also get up, he said. But
okay.
don't enter the dining room until you are called. Okay, and he said, do not approach His Highness. If he wants to talk to you, he will come to talk to you, but he must speak first. You must not put out your hand until he puts out his hand for a handshake.
Right,
you cannot say anything until he says something and look him directly in the eyes.
Oh, wow.
But always keep your head a little lower than his. So I said, oh, my gosh, I feel like, I'm in something out of, the feudal system.
The King and I. Sounds like the King and I. King of Siam.
So
yeah.
I get dressed, I'm looking like James Bond in this tuxedo.
Dapper.
And I go to there, and I'm way there, because these people are always late for their dinners, that's show of power.
Okay.
So get there exactly about 8 o'clock. The prince hasn't arrived. And I'm mingling with the crowd. And it's like a big, giant dinner table, I heard. It was going to be. But the room that we were in for cocktails and just hanging around before dinner was served and the prince arrived was all full of these people who were emissaries, ambassadors and so on, military people. And they were wondering who the hell I was.
Okay.
They thought that I was some type of ambassador or political representative from Europe or the United States, and they were coming up and introducing themselves and so on. And my friend Jack was there, and he was introducing me around as a famous scientist, And people were going, I've heard of you. They'd never heard of me.
they read the New York Times.
They were saying that to be polite.
That's nice. That's a nice thing.
Then the prince comes. And you know, because everybody stands up, they put their drink down, everybody behaves like good little boys or they're going to get their heads chopped off.
Right.
And he just comes around and he just looks in the room and he leaves. And then about 5 minutes later, one of the servants comes and says, dinner is served. And we walk into the dining room and one of the ministers or assistants or secretaries announced that the prince had to leave an urgent business and that the cousin of the prince, I have his name down, some Arabic name, is going to take his place and business will be done in his highness's name. Now, this person must have been some type of minister because people were calling him, you know, excellency.
Okay.
So he came in, and we're supposed to act the same way. And I was shocked because I was like two seats down from the head of the table where the prince's cousin's going to sit. My friend Jack was next to me, in his uniform.
Right.
And we're all standing up around the table, and he comes in. And we're not allowed to sit. I was told, do not sit until he sits first. Then he sits and we all sit.
Okay.
And then, of course, the glasses are filled with wine. And I was told by the secretary that when His Highness makes a toast, everybody stand up, hold the glass with your right hand, and he gives a toast, and he brings the cup up to his lip, and you bring the cup up to your lips, until he puts his cup down, you are not allowed to take the cup away from your lips.
Oh, wow.
He has to do it first.
All right.
So he makes the toast and drinks. After the toast and you put your cup down, he looks and you could say, very nice, or hear, hear.
Okay.
He makes a toast. Luckily, you know, he didn't make a toast.
Okay.
So he sat down. And, you know, and we have this, you know, drinking little appetizer and stuff. And I was shocked. He leans over and he speaks really good English and he looks at me and he goes, you're an American. What are you doing in my country?
Mm.
And I said, oh, my God.
What's the protocol on that answer?
He had these two enormous brutes standing behind him.
Yeah.
And when he said that and he looked at me, these guys just glared at me.
You better answer it right, or you can.
And I told him, and I looked at him, and I said, you know, Excellency, I'm here to study the jinn. And all of a sudden, he gets all excited, and he goes, the jinn! He goes, I will tell you about the jinn. And all the people are looking at him at the table, because he's like losing.
Oh, my.
And he said, the jinn are in my country. And he said, they come into my country, and he said, through a certain area in my country and nearby countries, and your government and the European government is working with my government to capture one of them.
Oh, wow.
Because they want technology from them. And I said, and then he said, did they ever catch one? He goes, I don't know. He said, that's classified information. And he starts, you know, telling me about the jinn, and people are looking at me like, you know, this conversation here. And then he looks at me and he goes, just out of the blue, this conversation is over with you. And he starts speaking Arabic to my friend Jack.
Okay.
And I don't know what the heck they're saying, but I'm sitting there like a good little boy because these two, you know, gorillas behind them are looking like, you know, they're getting ready to get the word to, you know, to pick me up and, you know, boot me out and, you know, somewhere down in the slums of Radia, an American in a tuxedo, which you'll never see again.
Exactly.
I'll never see the light again. So, you know, we had dinner, and he started talking to some of the other guests across the table and so on and so on. And then he did his business because there was, you know, these ministers and ambassadors there from different countries. And Jack walks me back. It was a long dinner. Jack walks me back about midnight to my place, and he said, I said, what were you talking to him about? He said, well, he said that he wants me to make sure that you go to a certain part where there's an old mosque, where there's a holy man there who knows all about the jinn. And he said he wanted me to arrange it. I said, oh, this is great. I mean,
it's perfect, Scott.
So I said, are you going to come, Jack? He says, no, but I'm going to send my captain with you, who was the guy who picked me up at the airport.
Okay,
He was an all right guy because I knew him then. And the next day, he picked me up very early, and he brings in a change of clothes. And he said, do not come in like, you know, these other clothes here or dressed like an American or European because you'll be a target because it's a very dangerous area of town. So he brings in these standard, you know, custom clothes, and I put them on, and they were very comfortable, but I felt like I was in the movie Lawrence of Arabia.
Phil, to know you is to love you.
So we go down to this place, and the holy man, and the captain tells me, I will translate for you, but, you know, you may ask questions, but you cannot continuously ask questions. You get one answer to a question, and that's it.
Oh, wow.
And I said, what is this place that we're going to? And we pulled up, and he said, it looked like an old, run-down, you know, place. And
church
he
or
said,
temple?
He
or?
Said, it's 300 years old, he said. And he said, it used to be some type of, you know, holy place, a mosque, a temple, and so on. And now, you know, of course, it's not, but, you know, it used to be that. So it used to be a pretty magical, sacred place. So we walk in, and there's this guy who looks like he's about 300 years old. He's sitting on the floor, and he's smoking a water pipe. And I'm saying, oh, my gosh, you know. And he's just puffing out that water pipe away. And it looks like he's in another dimension. I'm saying, I'm going to get intelligent answers from this guy.
The man with hashish always gives intelligent answers.
So I started asking questions, you know, about the jinn. And he's answering the questions. I got a lot of good information. Oh, my gosh, I was writing all this stuff down because, you know, he was speaking in Saudi, Arabic.
So wait, he gave you more than one answer?
No, he kept on going. He had very long answers.
I see. Okay.
He was
telling
me the entire history of the jinn, the mythology, the interactions, about them. This guy knew everything about the jinn. And I'm writing all this stuff down because I was not allowed to tape anything.
Okay.
They find that offensive. So I'm writing down all of these answers and, you know, trying to do it as quick as possible. And finally, it comes through, and he said, I must go to the country of Oman, which is alongside Saudi Arabia. The sea there.
Okay.
And the Oman Sea and the Gulf of Arabia and so on and so on. He said, there is a place called Majas al-Jinn, which translates into the meeting place of the jinn. It's a cave.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, I was there for a couple of hours, and then he said, you know, he was tired now. We had to leave, and that was it. We had to leave. This guy was, like, in that area, he was considered, like, some type of prophet.
Okay.
So we go back to, you know, the villa, and Yarn tells me he's going to arrange transportation on a personal jet go into the capital of Oman and land there, and we're going to take a vehicle that's going to be sent for us to take us down to the Hajjaz Mountains. This is a village near there where the jinn have been spotted where the cave is, the meeting place where the jinn come into our world. I said, oh, my gosh, this is great. My gosh. So the next morning, we get on this little private jet, and we're flying from Saudi Arabia to Oman, which was only about, like, 35 minutes. But you have to remember, on this plane, unbelievable. They had everything on there. If I asked for a hamburger and french fries, I probably could have gotten it.
Yeah.
But they had, you know.
Well, they have a chef, right? I mean, this is royalty, right? I mean,
I got a massage. I mean, you know, it's like unbelievable. And they had like this incredible library of music and stuff from, oh my gosh, it was like.
Oh, wow.
So we land at the airport and this vehicle picks us up. And there's a vehicle waiting for us, and we're driving down to the Hajjaz Mountains, which is along the coast, another like 60, 70 miles. We get to this village where we're going to change vehicles because the vehicle we have is for the road. We needed a four-wheel one to go up into the mountainous areas. And we're in this little village. And there, we spend the night because in the day we're going to go to the cave. Now, there we picked up a guide who, you know, they were paying for, and I was with the captain, Yar, and he was going to take us. And the guide says, well, there's somebody I should talk to in the village. And it was a teacher who spoke perfect English. We had dinner with him, and he told me a story. When he was in the mountains near the cave, he encountered a Janaya, which is a female jinn. And
okay.
He encountered the female jinn with her child. And he said he got very terrified because he thought that the jinn was just a superstitious. But this was a jinn, and she was, like, you know, scary looking and had all this power. And when she saw him, she was very protective of her child, and she made like a whirlwind and everything and blew him back, and then she disappeared. He thought that the Janaya was going to kill her because Janayas are known to be very protective of their young, and they're more vicious than the male jinn. Jinn have male and female.
Okay.
Now, he says, then something happened that scared me more. And I said, what? He said, over the hill, helicopters came and jeeps, and they didn't say anything. They were military men. He said they were from my country, which is Oman. They were Saudi, and they were Americans. And they picked me up and put me in the jeep and took me to the center area of the mountains where there was a compound. He said, in it, I was taken into a room, and I was interrogated for 3 hours as to what I saw. He said there was a military operation in the mountains that was trying to capture one of these creatures that come into our world, these Janaya, these jinn, because they can take on human form, and they can take on the form of animals. And he said he was more afraid of these people who were interrogating him than he was of the jinn. And they told him, and he was afraid to say anything else that took place. But this confirmed right away what the cousin of the prince told me about an operation, about trying to capture one of these dimensional beings.
Yeah.
So I'm writing all this information down and getting it down. So we spend the night, and we do some sightseeing, a beautiful country. Oman is absolutely gorgeous. You know, it's so clean there. There's no littering. You know, like you drive up and down the highway here and you see people
throwing
McDonald's and so on. Over there, nothing like that is done. Do you know why? Because...
Well, first of all, before you answer, what is the environment? Is it, I mean, it's sand or...
No. It's
I've never been to another country,
It's along the coast, you know, the coast, the Arabian Sea and so on, and the Oman Sea.
Okay.
And
so what kind of trees? Are there trees?
There's trees, but it's mostly open area with mountains in the distance, and there's shrubs and stuff, but it's beautifully tailored, everything. Everything looks like it's from a picture. And there's no rubbish or no litter at all. Everything is like they go out and polish the rocks, you know?
Oh, wow.
And there's a reason for that.
Because which is?
They take pride in their country. If you're caught littering in your country, you go to jail. I think that's the only country where they have the death sentence for littering.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Well, and it helps that they don't have a whole lot of McDonald's around. I mean, you know, I'm assuming...
No, there's no McDonald's here.
Right. So, I mean, what are you going to litter with? Nature? You can't litter nature with nature, you know?
If you're a foreigner visiting that country...
Oh, I see. Okay,
know,
right.
And the people
right.
know better, but, you know, they have people come into that country. Right now, it's not a very safe country to go to, but, you know, back then it was okay.
Right.
So we're in this little village, you know, next to the Hajar Mountains. They must fish something. I had all written down. It's all in the book. I can't remember the names of these cities. These towns. And did some sightseeing around the area that night, and it was nice and cool standing at a little villa, you know, outside the sea and everything. This water, nice green, sky is perfect blue, it's silent, it's warm and everything. The next day, we get ready for our trip, which was about an hour drive into the mountains. There's the trails going up there. And before we get into the thing, I notice in the back there are three handguns.
Mm.
And I said to Yar, what do we need those for? their 9mm Berettas. He said, where we're going could be dangerous from bandits, and we'd rather have them and not need them than to need them and not have them. I said, well, okay, you know, it makes sense. You know, I'm in a foreign country, there are guns and everything. So our, you know, person, our guide went with us. He only spoke Arabic. And we're driving up into the mountains, and we come to the area. We had to park the vehicle down by a thing. We had to climb up a ridge and walk up. It wasn't too much. But it was still early in the morning, and the sun was kind of low. And I thought I was going to be able to walk into a cave, you know, and see this place.
Mm-hmm.
No way. The only entrance was from the top. There were two holes in the top, which you have to rappel down over 300 feet.
Oh, wow.
Now, at that time, the sun was rising up, the sun was shining in the holes, and I looked down. Later, I found out that inside that cave, the Majlis al-Jinn, it's big enough in there to fit the Great Pyramid of Giza in.
Oh, my God.
So we hook up the rope, and it goes down into the thing. You know, we had like 500 feet of rope, but it went all the way down. And I said, okay, is our guide going to go first? And Yar looks at me and goes, oh, no, my friend.
You're on your own.
You are going alone. Wow. I said, oh, my gosh, I went all this way, and I'm going to be afraid to go down. I said, I've done rappelling before and so on. But, you know, this is a different situation. So I put, you know, the harness on, and I put the rappelling, you know, the clamps on and everything. I started going down.
Wow, Phil. Very courageous. Very courageous.
Yeah, well, anyway, you know, stupidity, maybe.
Well, who, you know, I think it's a fine line, stupidity and courage, but
anyway,
it gets the job done.
Anyway, I'm going down. I'm down about 150 feet. And now the sun's higher in the sky, so it's shining down there. And there's a mist down there.
Okay.
And it looked very eerie. And I see this mist rising up. It's greenish.
Mm.
And now everything's echoing in this cavern. It's like one of the fifth biggest cavern in the world.
Okay.
And I think I hear some type of voice or muttering, but I couldn't tell.
Okay.
And this mist, like, is coming up from the bottom. And it's mist, like, looks like it's glowing. I don't know if it was because the sun was there.
Okay.
But then the guide and the captain up above, they start screaming back and forth to each other in Arabic. I have no idea what they're saying, but their echo, the voices are coming through the opening of the cavern.
Right.
But I understood one word.
What?
Jinn.
Jinn, I knew. Wow.
All of a sudden, when I hear jinn, I look up, and they're gone.
Are you just dangling in the middle?
That's right. They're gone. So, what do I do next? I climb back up.
Oh, wow.
Okay. I climb back up, and I come to the hole, and I see them running down the hill. Both of them. Running like, you know, they got fire on their pants.
Right,
and I'm going, where are you going? And he leans back and says, get out of here now, my friend. He says, the jinn told us to get out.
Oh,
and
wow.
And I'm saying to myself, this is a once-in-a-lifetime thing. Do I wait here, or do I go? They were going to jump in the Jeep and take off and leave me there. And I'm saying, this wouldn't be very good, because here I am, somewhere on the other side of the world, an American.
Yeah,
nothing,
yeah.
And everything is back at where we were staying, no money or anything.
Yeah.
Not even my passport, not even a vehicle, and I have to walk for 5 days to get to the town.
Yeah.
So I'm running down the hill after them.
Oh, God, I wish you stayed, too. Okay, I mean, just because I wish I mean, aren't you to this day curious what was in the cave?
Well, you know, I think about it today, but they said it was a jinn, the green mist was a jinn, and it took shape, and it was speaking in Arabic to them, and it was telling them to get out of my house, get out of my place, or we will kill you. That's why they left, because you have to remember that their deep-rooted beliefs of the jinn are very strong, like Catholics,
of course,
devil.
Of course,
so,
right.
I go down, and they're ready to take off, and I jump in the vehicle, and I start taking off. They're speeding away, and they're in the front, and I'm in the back, and I barely make it in, and they're talking back in Arabic, saying all these prayers and everything in Arabic, and the captain looks back, and he says, you know, I heard stories of the jinn, but I never thought they existed, but now I'm sure they existed. So we get back to the village. Now get this. The guide is all upset, and he's telling the villagers and the local constable what happened. And they're all around me yelling at me in Arabic. And Yara's saying, they're saying that you woke up the jinn. And now
I was going to say, they're going to blame you for this. Oh.
Yeah. And Yara said, we should leave now. At once, we should leave. So we took in the jeep. And you have to imagine this picture. We jump in the vehicle, and we're driving back to the capital city in the airport with these people throwing rocks at us and chasing us.
Oh,
running
wow.
after our jeep and throwing rocks and sticks at us while we're running away. They were very serious about what was going on.
Yeah.
So anyway, I made it finally back to, you know, Saudi Arabia. And then from then on there, I went to, actually I went to Syria. And I actually went into the borderline of Iraq and Iran. I circled around to Iran from Oman and that area there. And but Syria was where I picked up a lot more information. And that was a little difficult to get through because there's a lot of action going on there. Anyway, then I flew back to the United States just in time for Christmas vacation to be over. And went back to school, walked into my classroom, you know, Mr. Mild-mannered science teacher doing all these equations. I had no idea what I'd been through. And I'm saying to myself, I remind myself from an Indiana Jones movie, you know.
I love it. It's the epitome of, and what did you do on summer vacation?
and then what happened is that during the teachers' meeting before the end of the beginning of the year, the director of the school, who was a woman, we were sitting at the table and we were all discussing. And what did you do at your vacation? And they came to me, and everybody was saying they did this. And I said, I really didn't do much of anything. And the director of the school goes, don't give us that, Phil. Sometimes you're in these foreign countries, and who knows, God, what you're doing there. In front of all these people who think I'm just, you know, Mr. Science, you know,
exactly.
Mr. I, the science guy, and I just go home to my lab coat and sleep in my lab coat all the time and watch, you know, Sci-Fi Channel and just watch that and read science books all day. And so all this information, by the way, that I picked up on the jinn and my adventures over there, including into Syria and so on, are all in the book that's coming out in March called The Vengeful Jinn. You could actually order it on Amazon now. It's available there.
Let me interrupt. I want the listeners to know that if right on the episode page, you can order the Jinn book, you can order Files from the Edge, and you can order the Multiple Universe book. I posted all three, and they're direct links to Amazon, so I just want them to know that.
Yeah, so you can order, the books are available now to be ordered, so, I just got a note from my publisher saying, you know, we love your books rock. They tell adventure. They enjoy reading them because, you know, they're not just like in many other books that sit down and people just, you know, read other books and they just decide to put down what they know. All my books are primarily my adventures investigating the paranormal. And, you know, and some of them are like Indiana Jones episodes. But,
yeah.
You know, it ties it all together with my scientific knowledge. Because I put, you know, science and quantum physics together with dimensions and then bring in mythology to tie it all together to fully explain to my readers exactly what's going on here and the information that I found. So if you read my book Night Siege, which is the first book on UFOs that I wrote, all the way up to, you know, the book that's coming out, Portals and Files from the Edge 2, everything in between, you see how my attitude has changed and regarding my investigations of the paranormal. So it's almost like one book complements the other.
Yeah, and you're an excellent writer. I mean, I remember when Files came out, And I was interviewing you like 3 days later, and I was like, I need the book. I want, you know, it just makes a, I enjoy reading your books, but I wanted to read it for the interview. And
you can plug it.
Is that the one I was in? Well, no. They're not that one. The one before it, the multiverse.
The multiverse.
No, they took me out of the multiverse. Remember, Llewellyn took me out, and you got upset with them. Whichever one it was, I read it in one day, and not that it was just. I was truly enchanted. It's just, Phil is a scientist, but hands down, you've got some kind of Native American quality because you're a master storyteller. It's just you're very engaging in how you tell stories, whether verbally or writtenly. It's just a very engaging journey you go on, and it's entertaining as well as informative, as well as enchanting. You know, it really is. It encompasses everything, and I think that's what your publishers are realizing because your readers are. You know, I definitely want Files 2 and the Portals book. I mean. I'll be honest with you. I don't want to read about the gym because I don't want to invite him into my house. Goldie plays too much with the dark. I dabble in the darkness, so I'll just stick with my own wisdom about that. But I definitely want to read Portals too, the Portal book and Files too, because they're fascinating. They're true accounts, right? I assume that the Files 2 is going to be just more true accounts, right?
Yeah, the Files is from my library of all the cases that I've investigated.
Exactly.
Been sitting there for a while. But in the Portals book, this summer, Rosemary and I did a lot of investigation up into Massachusetts, and we went through a lot of interesting. Massachusetts is like one of the most haunted states in the country. I mean, we were in a town called Yarmouth Port, on Cape Cod. And
right.
She was taking me up and down the street because she knew quite a bit because she's been around that area quite a few times and interacted with a lot of the paranormal investigators there. And she's saying, well, this house here is haunted with so-and-so. This. I'm going, my gosh, we were up and down the street. Which house wasn't haunted? It's like a unique thing for a house not to be haunted there. It's like when you buy a house, people buy a house up there, they want it to be haunted. If it's not haunted, they got to get their money back or something.
Really? Huh.
But
now, do you think that the land has something to do with that or the houses have something to do with that?
No, I think it's the land, but the houses have, local legends, and some of them are very old. And not only of, ghosts and stuff like that hauntings, but there's also reports of, history of strange creatures that come out of the swamp and so on and so on. And we visited a number of those areas, one called the Ledge in Assiniboine. And there's a lot of stone structures up there. There's chambers up in there.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw a rock called the Digton Rock, which has all these inscriptions on there that people think now are, Celtic and Viking and so on and so on. And I saw that for the first time because I'd only heard about it before. It's truly amazing. I mean, people carved in that rock, who visited that area, way before Columbus. And these areas also are now considered haunted or sacred by Native Americans, just like, the stone chambers around the Hudson Valley.
Right. Well, it does seem like you have a natural inclination to draw these chamber-like spaces into your presence, even with the one that you went to, whatever the place next to Saudi Arabia. I mean, it wasn't a chamber, but it was a big cave. Yeah.
Well, nobody's been in there for such a long time because people were afraid to go in there. And here I am. I go down there and I wake up the djinn, and now they're probably terrifying and terrorizing the neighborhood.
Well, have you ever asked if anything ever happened or came after, if anything happened to the village or anything after you left?
No, there's hardly any way you can find out. I mean, you really can't find
out. Yeah, there's
out.
No communication, right.
Yeah,
right.
This was a really small village, and people were nice and friendly until I came back and the guy told them that they woke up the djinn. And they,
yeah.
they, were, pretty pissed off after that. I mean, you can imagine, it's like out of a movie. We're driving away in this Jeep, you know, four-wheel Jeep, driving back up on the highway back to the airport. As we're going out of town and starting to step on the gas, practically the whole village is running after the thing, throwing rocks at us.
Yeah, that's crazy. That's crazy. Well, now, have you ever encountered the djinn, like, face-to-face, if that's even possible?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, I think that I've been in situations in paranormal investigations where there was djinn involved. And, you know, we've been doing a lot of work with, you know, electronic, you know, voice phenomena, picking up voices on radio sweep.
Okay.
I've got some really, really good sections and tapes. You know, we've actually got some good EVP around the chambers, especially the King's Chamber.
Yep.
Now, there's a house, you know, over in Putnam County that has a chamber on its road, and the house has been going through all of this paranormal stuff. And Rosemary's been keeping more taps on it than I am. But I tell you that it's so bad that the people moved in, they thought they were getting a dream house at a decent price.
Right.
And they want to, you know, and they're thinking about, I think they're seriously considering moving out now.
Right. Now, it turned out to be
there,
the nightmare for a cheap price.
When we were there, now they have a dog, okay?
Mm.
The dog's name is Lucy. This big, massive dog, part mastiff and everything. Anyway, the dog sees all this stuff, and it's driving the dog crazy, you know? Now, one of the things on the EVP, we picked up a voice that said, that was calling the dog's name. We didn't hear it. When we played it back, it was there. You know, when you play, download it to the computer, you can hear it much better.
Yeah,
yeah. The little, you know, the recorders. And the voice said, Rosemary said, is there anybody who wants to say something before we turn off the radio? And the voice comes on and says, Lucy.
Oh, wow.
Lucy,
she can go.
And now, come on, saying the dog's name. Now, recently we found out that the dog, you know, may be terminally ill.
Oh.
So the voice saying, you know, Lucy, she can go. Evidently, what was in that house didn't want the dog there.
I was just about to say that. Like,
Yeah, so, you know, things like this with EVP, picking up stuff in investigations and so on and so on. Do you know that there's a real estate law now in New York, in that area, in Putnam County, that if you're selling a house and you've had unusual experiences, paranormal in the house, you're supposed to disclose that before the closing?
I believe that.
That's a law now.
Yeah, because, right, too many people are buying into houses that they're not looking for the hauntings,
they're getting the hauntings. Yeah,
and
they're moving into the Amityville Horror.
Exactly, which is why it's so interesting how in Massachusetts they're looking for it. It's like, oh, that's...
And there's a different mentality up there. It's almost like it's part of the culture.
Huh.
I mean, you know, we went up there, and that evening we had dinner with a number of the local, you know, ghost hunters.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're sitting down at a Chinese restaurant and dinner, and they're telling stories of how they've had these encounters with these ghosts and spirits and everything else, just like they were, you know, talking about they just met, you know, Billy Bob down at the drugstore the other day. I mean,
it just hit me. That's Salem, right? I would assume there are lots of hauntings. They were killing lots of people up there, so...
This is in Cape Cod. Cape Cod is a very haunted place. It's also a very crowded place.
Crowded haunting-wise or crowded population
people,
of humans?
You know.
Oh, people.
Ghosts
okay.
don't take up that much room, but people do.
So but they require room.
So we were up there in July, and that was like prime time for Cape Cod.
Oh, yeah, that's tourist time.
Coming
yeah.
in. I mean, like, the place was packed. You couldn't even get across the bridge because it was so backed up. But, you know, we did a lot. We went to a lot of places and did some decent investigation up in there. And that's all in the Portals book because we identify one area up there, the Hockomock Swamp area around a place called the Bridgewater Triangle. as a portal area in which phenomena from another close by dimension enters our reality from time to time.
And you documented that?
Well, you know, we documented story. We went to there and went to places and so on. And, you know, we had some mild experiences, but most of all, it's, you know, information and research being picked up and seeing things like the Dignam Rock and hearing the stories about, you know, the Indian graveyards that are right across the river and this spook light and everything like that.
Okay.
But I have to say the spookiest place we went to was the place called The Ledge. And, and it was very strange because we finally found the place and parked the car and started walking down the trail. And we're walking and walking and walking and walking. And I said, you know, we're going to come to a ledge with a pond beneath it. I said, it doesn't look like them in the geography. All of a sudden, this fella comes by on a dirt bike. And he stops by and just, you know, stops the bike and lifts off his helmet and just looks at us. And we said, well, you know, is there a ledge down there? He says, yeah, another 2 miles. Now, we've already been walking about 40 minutes.
Okay.
And I'm saying to myself, oh, my gosh, you know, it's summer, it's kind of hot. I'm saying, I don't feel like walking another 2 miles, but I'm not going to walk back and come all this distance.
Right.
So we continued on walking. All of a sudden, the sky started to get real dark. Like,
oh, boy.
Four.
Yeah.
And I could see flashes in the distance, and I'm saying, you know, this doesn't look good. We kept on walking, you know, hoping that if it rains or something, we find shelter and lightning. We turn around the corner. It wasn't 2 miles. It was only like another 5-minute walk. And all of a sudden, there was this enormous pond with this ledge, rock ledge, that rose up 100 feet into the air. And this was the ledge that we were looking for. And all of a sudden, the sun came out, and all these dark clouds were gone. Almost like some type of energy was being, you know, channeling and making this, you know, weather phenomena, which you hear a lot about in that area. Now, this is an area where a creature called the Pukwudgie is supposed to live. The Pukwudgie is almost like a little troll-like creature that they have a power over human beings where they chase them in the night and they make them run up the ledge and they jump off into the water. Now, according to what I understand, people have dived off that ledge and died, committed suicide.
Okay.
And that people have jumped off the ledge into the pond, and the bodies have never been recovered. It's almost as if these Pukwudgie guys, according to legend, want the people to jump off so they can fall into a portal and go into their universe to do whatever they do with them.
Oh,
and
wow.
We went up to the ledge. We went there and took some pictures, and we went up to the ledge, and it was unbelievable. There was like a feeling up there that was really dark. And Rosemary was walking closer and closer to the ledge, and I was telling her, you know, you better get by. And I was walking to the ledge, and you almost had this desire to jump off. It's like something was telling you to jump. I mean, it was like this, one of the strangest things I've ever felt, because, you know, I was getting closer and closer to the ledge. I'm usually very careful.
Yeah.
I know my own mortality. If I fall
off a
100-foot ledge into the water, I'm going to be a phenomenon myself. Anyway, and Rosemary later, when we compared notes, had the same feeling to get closer and closer to the edge.
Now, did you have like any kind of electromagnetic things with you? Was there an energy or?
Well, the only thing that we saw, the flashes in the clouds and the sky got pretty dark for a while, but that was about it.
Well, right, and that's clearly an indicator. I agree with that. Yeah,
well, there was a feeling there, you know, and we had some equipment there that we set up, and we were getting some readings, but we didn't see any Pukwudgies or anything like that.
Right.
But the thing is that it is a very bizarre place, and there was evidence that there's a lot of rituals being done up there, occult rituals, satanic in origin, it seems like, and also other occult rituals that were done over the years. Now, the lake below, the lake is strange because it's just as wide as the ledge. So if you jump off anywhere in the ledge, you're going to end up in the water. Now, that lake, it's never been discovered how deep that lake really is. It seems to have no bottom. And the water, the water is ice cold. You know what that tells me?
It does have no bottom.
that tells me it's very deep.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's like black. And water, I mean, when you put your hand in the water, it was almost like you got that cold feeling of what some people described as death.
Oh, wow. So you guys went down? So you did put your hand, you touched the water?
Yeah, I touched the water, you know.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And then we went up to the ledge and everything and took some pictures from up there and so on. But anyway, our visit there and the legend of the Pakwaji and so on, you know, the stories and everything are all things. In that area there, there's supposed to have been a lot of murders. And a lot of, you know, sightings of apparitions, and nobody really knows how many bodies are at the bottom of that lake. So it's a very bizarre area. A lot of that area of Massachusetts is strange. I mean, I couldn't believe it, you know. It's got a very dark feeling to it, too. So,
can I ask you a question? Is the military present anywhere near there?
Well, they're military bases, yeah.
Because isn't in one of your books you said there's criteria, and military presence is one of the criteria, right?
No, that was on a show, the UFO Hunters.
Oh, okay.
You know, but that I was on. I didn't say that, but in areas where there's an intense amount of paranormal activity, you do find some type of operation or small operation of military personnel probably trying to observe the phenomena.
Right.
There's no major bases. There are major bases in Massachusetts, but if anything, you know, the military and these government agencies that are involved in this will send in teams to set up camps in the area, and they'll more or less disguise themselves as, you know, construction workers or pipeline workers or electrical workers or something, so they can go unnoticed and document the phenomena.
Right.
But, you know, it was an interesting July. I mean, you know.
Yeah, well, I know. I was surprised that we weren't doing more, you know, chamber work or, you know, just, it was all good. Because you had told me that you were writing, like, two books and the PhD. So I was definitely curious what was you know, what's going on and where you've been and, you know, what's showing up. What's showing up? Because God knows you don't travel in the average circle.
Well, that's for certain. You know, it seems natural for me. But this September, the Labor Day weekend, I was up in New Hampshire, and I think I talked to you on the phone from there. When you
called. Yes. You were, I think, at the UFO convention, right?
I went to the Exeter, New Hampshire UFO Festival as one of the speakers.
Okay.
And Exeter, New Hampshire, of course, is a hotbed for UFOs, and I think that the people up in Exeter are trying to make Exeter like the UFO capital for the Northeast.
Okay.
And they have this conference every year. And there were a number of speakers, including myself. It was a very nice time, I have to admit that. And there were over 300 people that showed up.
Oh, nice.
And
that's
nice. You know, it was a free conference.
Okay.
And that could be one of the reasons. But it was very well done, and if anybody ever gets the chance, they have it once a year. Look at it online for the next one, which is next year, and it's worth your while to go there because all you got to do is drive up there and get the hotel, but the conference itself is free.
Yeah.
And it surprised me because usually when you go to places like that, you don't sell very many books. I actually bought like 40 copies of Night Siege. And sold all 40 of them.
That was
pretty phenomenal because there was a big interest in the UFO phenomena up there because Exeter was a very hot spot. And, of course, the fellow who wrote the book Incident at Exeter, which was published back in the 60s, was a writer by the name of John G. Fuller, who passed away in the 90s, and he was actually one of my mentors. And I knew him very well, so I gave a tribute to him at the beginning of my speech. I was asked to give a tribute to him. And because if it wasn't for his book, The Exit, you know, I said to the audience, listen, if it wasn't for John G. Fuller writing this book about incident at Exeter that became very popular and a bestseller, we wouldn't have this conference today.
Right.
Because those sightings would have gone practically unnoticed.
And when was that? When was his sightings? In the 90s?
No. He died in the 90s.
Oh, when was his sightings?
He didn't have sightings. He wrote the book about the sightings in Exeter back in the 60s, like 1965.
Oh, but they weren't personal. He wasn't personally involved in them.
No,
he just wrote about them.
He was the investigator. He was the investigative
writer
that went up there and talked to the police officers and the witnesses who had this close encounter with this object. And the sightings weren't nearly as as impressive or as the Hudson Valley case. But still, because John Fuller wrote about it and it became a bestseller, it's become a classic in UFO literature. But if John didn't write that book and do the investigation and go up there, today nobody would know about the Exeter sightings. And I said to the audience, if it wasn't for John writing the book about the sightings here, we wouldn't be having this conference today.
Yeah. Interesting what gets everything going. Because I would assume Night Siege is somewhat of a classic?
Well, it's a classic when you consider that, books today, when they come out, they usually only stay in print for a few years. Night Siege has been in print for over 25 years.
Yeah, that would definitely, I think, resort as a classic. And it's interesting because even though it was written, a while ago, it's almost like the information is still pertinent because there's still no disclosure on UFOs. Because let me ask you a question. In your lifetime, do you believe the government will ever come out and acknowledge the UFO activity?
No. I don't believe it's going to happen.
Really?
No. I don't believe it's going to happen until they're forced to do it. And there's only very few people in the government, really, who really know what's going on. It's not like a universal knowledge in the government. It's a very small section of the government that's operating this thing as part of the intelligence organizations, part of naval intelligence.
Right.
And, things will leak out. They'll let things leak out so people feel more comfortable with the increased sightings that they're having. But they'll never really come out and admit that they've known all along. It's deniability.
Sad. It's so sad when people with their own camcorders are clearly, filming something.
Well, there's a lot of new UFO stuff that has appeared on YouTube and stuff. I'd say 95% of it's all faked with digital.
Oh, really?
Oh, I'm sure it is. I mean, the things that you can do with Photoshop today, things that you can do with digital, you can fake these UFO pictures like crazy. Back in the old days when you use ordinary film and ordinary videotape, it was pretty hard to get something across that was faked. But now digital is like a whole different, animal. And a picture that's taken of a UFO or video today of a UFO is only as good as the witnesses and the photographer's credibility.
Right. Well, what about that thing in Oslo, Norway? What, do you have any opinions on that spiral thing?
I think it was covered up quite well, and nobody really knows what it was, but I think it was some type of dimensional opening.
Yeah, the portal, that's what it felt like to me as well.
Yeah, so, that was covered up pretty well. But you see, people, heard about it, and all of a sudden they said, well, it was a Russian rocket that went haywire and so on. I mean, then people accept that and say, oh, it was just a Russian rocket because they heard it on TV. This is the way Americans have been programmed. They're led to believe that everything they hear on TV, especially on the news, is the truth.
I know. So naive.
I mean,
I'm naive, but I'm not that naive. Yeah.
Use that, the media, to, in fact, control the thinking of the human race the way they want to. And that goes with UFOs, too. Everything that's out there has been conditioned for people to believe a certain way.
Right. Well, that whole control issue.
Sightings, but you can also make it so confusing or make it so terrifying that people either, refuse to believe it because it's so confusing or just can't process the information, or they can make
right.
the information so terrifying that people are afraid to believe in it and laugh at it in defense and say, oh, that's not really real.
Yeah, and we've talked about that because I do believe that they're, you know, because I think the sightings are happening from what I'm being exposed to more and more people personally. You know, in other words, they are personally having experiences that once, I mean, I know from my own experience, once it's personal, it's no longer, is it real? I mean, my next question is, who is it? You know, who was it that I was interacting with? Because that's just the nature of anything once it becomes a personal experience. It's no longer, you know, you don't look for the government to confirm or deny. I don't anyways. And I would assume that most people don't. You know, they start looking to other sources, you know, sources such as yourself and, you know, other people. Even though inevitably I tell people, if you have experiences, that means the answers are within you. Go within you and, you know, uncover it. Even though to this day I still have not uncovered, you know, remember that baby thing? I don't know what that was about. I've actually, in some of my exposure to other teachings, have the sense that maybe there is a hybrid baby that, you know, my genetics were involved in creating. And I say that with a definite question mark at the end. I don't know that that's what I feel is truth, whether it is or it isn't. It's something that... if I don't feel it in my own being is my truth, you know, I just keep looking, you know, outside as well as, you know, through meditation. I watch my dreams because I'm starting to get that, you know, this whole idea of conscious, subconscious, and unconscious, you know, are really just levels of this. It's all one consciousness. It's just level of awareness we have in that consciousness. And, you know, if we're open to being conscious, completely conscious, that which is sub and unconscious will basically be revealed to us. And I have, you know, stated that intention in my own little quiet way that, you know, I'm ready to experience whatever happened fully, you know, because I'm not going to freak out if I do have a baby, you know, in another, you know, a hybrid baby. I'm not going to, you know, because I don't know what that baby thing is. I just know, I thought it was going to mean I was going to have a physical child, and because that hasn't happened yet, it's making me go, maybe it was, I had a child, but not, you know, in this dimension. What do you think about that?
Have you
ever heard about any of that?
Of course I have.
Yeah, okay.
You know, I've talked to people, women who were taken aboard these ships, so to speak, and there were humans there and hybrids and working with these alien guys, whoever they are, and they would bring out a little baby and say, you know, it's yours.
Right.
And it was a hybrid. And in one case, a woman was taken into a room, and she saw all these canisters filled with, you know, these hybrid babies that they were incubating.
Oh. Okay.
That they took out from the wombs of supposedly of women, you know, so that it would look like the pregnancy was terminated, but they would remove it and put it in these canisters till they're developed, you know, until they can take them out.
Okay.
You know, so they, you know, incubate them in women, according what I understand, and then come and get them, you know, while they're still tiny little fetuses and put them in these, you know, incubation chambers.
Right.
So, I mean, this woman, she was serious about what she thought. I've heard the story a number of times, and where people walked in these rooms, enormous rooms with thousands of canisters with piled on top of each other, you know, all bubbles
right.
in them and everything, like something from some sci-fi movie. So, you know, if this was just one account, you know, you could dismiss it or, you know, or just a handful, but it's not just restricted to the United States. There are stories like this coming in from all over the world.
Exactly.
And of course, you know,
exactly.
when you tell this type of story, people think you're crazy. If a woman says, well, I was taken aboard and I saw my baby was in a canister, they told me, or they brought one out who was taken just out of the canister and told me it was mine and, you know, alien DNA, what are they going to do? They're going to say, you know, let's go see the doctor, make an appointment. psychiatrist. So then you believe in this stuff, and you believe in this stuff. Then you go see the psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist says, you're having delusions. Let's put you on Thorazine. And then you start taking the Thorazine, and you don't see anything anymore.
Well, exactly. Exactly. I mean, I would. There will be no Thorazine in Goldie's future. But like I said, I'm just open to, because I've been learning about, you know, that this race is basically the Greys, and this is my understanding. The Greys are actually humans from a parallel dimension, but they literally genetically altered themselves so much that they were destined to become extinct. But because Greys are indeed human, just parallel humans, that they did have agreements with us, even if we didn't remember, and that these abductions were the agreements and the contracts, because they had to, in order to keep the species going, they had to make hybrids of Greys and humans. And the teacher that I've been listening to and garnishing this information from, I mean, I have thousands upon thousands of hours of these teachings, and, you know, people in all, many different people, some the same, but they're all coming up going, yeah, I've had experiences, and, you know, the channeler, which is, I know you're not big on channelers, the channeler is confirming it. So, you know, of course, I started thinking about my experience and saying, well, I wonder if, you know, I've got a little hybrid baby, and, you know, if I do, I'm all for multidimensionality anyways. I mean, I don't feel violated. I told you from the beginning I never felt violated, not when I went on the ship and not when I had the experience of the baby. You know, it just never felt violating to me. I'm all about, you know, like there's a lot of stuff on Facebook where you're seeing dolphins and dogs swimming together and deers and cats playing in the backyard. It's like interspecies mingling, so to speak, I think is a very natural path in evolution, and our evolution is galactic species intermingling with us, you know, because we're galactic in the sense that we're in Earth and we're out there in the middle of the cosmos, just like, you know, all the other planets. So, you know, I think it's just a matter of awareness before we recognize that we've already been interacting with them. We're just not, you know, we're still compartmentalizing our consciousness, so we forget. But as we become aware, we'll become aware that we're part of a larger family than just quote unquote the humans on Earth. You know, there's humanoid beings on many planets out there, and, you know, I'm not just looking for the sound, you know, like what is it, the SETI is, you know, sending out the pulse or whatever. You know, I'm looking for, you know, my little girl. Boy, only on the show with you could I say this. without the white coats coming. But, you know, it's like everybody's got a destiny, right? It's, you know, it
yeah,
is what
I,
it is.
You know, I hope these other beings aren't watching Spike TV right now. Because they won't have a very high opinion. There's two women wrestling right now, and they look like two gorillas. Oh, my gosh, we got to stay away from that planet.
Yeah, well, I think that they're encouraging us to become aware, but that, because let me ask you if you've ever heard this. I'm just kind of curious about the cross-reference, because I know you don't do channelers, so there's just cross-referencing if there is acknowledgement. This channeler basically said 2012, the quarantine would be lifted, and it's not that, you know, January 1st, 2013, the, you know, spaceships are going to land on the White House lawn, but at that point it's no longer a quarantine, it's no longer galactic law that they can't interfere, and all they're really waiting for is our level of consciousness to be open to the idea of interspecies communication, that it, in other words, it'll be us, the humans, that will determine when they'll land, not law saying we're in quarantine. Have you ever heard that before?
Oh, I hear stories like that all the time. I've been hearing it for years. And
2012, though? Around 2012?
No, before that. It was supposed to happen in 1999 and other dates and so on.
Oh, okay. Okay, that makes sense.
I mean,
okay.
I don't give it much credibility to channelers, because some of them can put on a good act. And,
right.
You know, most of them are people who are looking for an audience anyway. And,
yes.
You know, and I went to Chandler from here to Mars, you know, and,
yeah.
And there's only like about four that have convinced me that they were actually in contact with another human intelligence. I think the rest of them, I think, are just, you know, full of malarkey.
Right, and I honor that. That's why I don't try to bring it up with you because I know how you feel about it. So I honor that.
I'd probably do the same thing. If I sat down and invited everybody over, started going to a trance and started talking about certain things in the universe, I'm sure I could get a pretty big following after charging them $100 a piece to walk into my house.
Right.
Know,
no.
But, I'm not saying that channeling isn't real. I'm just saying that it's a lot rarer than we think it is. Now,
I agree. I agree.
Everybody and their cat and dog is channeling something now, and it's a big craze. And some people are actually charlatans. Some people are just fooling themselves. That they
Indeed.
Think they are. Some people are charlatans and, you know, who are doing it because they see it's an easy way to make a buck and suck people into getting their money. And there's a very rare element out there that really is in contact, and these people are, you know, they don't have control over the situation. And it's a dog of a different color, so to speak. It's a whole different
right.
situation than some of the channelers who want an audience and sing and do all this stuff here. And you know, I've been to a number of them, and there was one particular case where this woman was channeling the angel Gabriel, and I've been to a lot of channelers and heard of a lot of channelers who channel Gabriel. So, you know, this Gabriel must be, he must be a pretty busy guy. He's going over the place. And
I think Archangel, Saint Germain is a little busier than Gabriel, but anyways, keep going. A lot of people channel Saint Germain.
Yeah, Saint Germain too, you know, who knows. But anyway, you know, I said to the channel, I have to ask you a bunch of questions. I get these long-winded spiritual things, and I just wanted some basic information. So this Gabriel talking through this channeler was starting to get upset with me. And I'm saying, gee, you know, he's not very nice here. I mean, this is an archangel, a higher, developed spiritual being. It's losing its temper. And I'm saying to myself, and they said, okay, you, and they always talk with this like Indian accent or something. You may ask one more question. And I said, what's the capital of North Dakota? And Gabriel, in the trance, you know, could not answer what the capital of North Dakota was. It seems strange to me that an archangel didn't know the capital of North Dakota.
Right.
So, you know, after that, you know, I was politely asked to leave by Gabriel, and I was never invited back to that particular session of Gabriel, whose channel is this angel. And there's another person, you know, a couple of guys called Raphael who channel, you know, the angel Raphael, until one guy claimed that he was actually the archangel Raphael. And, you know, a lot of this mystical, magical stuff, especially that involved men, if you look at their audience, the majority of their audience are female, and
right.
they're women. And this goes
right.
back to the, you know, the Carlos Castaneda cult, where he would have all of these women around him all the time, and they would be like subservient to him because they thought he was this great mystical master. And he was just, you know, using it to manipulate to get free sex.
I don't know. I've read his books. I find Carlos to be quite expanded. I had trouble following a lot of his work, but I didn't find him to be a charlatan. I mean, that's just me. But we've always had this disagreement. I mean, I think, you know, different information is going to come through. Like, you got it directly from the chambers in your experience. I often get my awareness through people, you know, that are, because, like, I think everybody has something, you know, a level of consciousness for them to hear that is truth. In other words, it's truth to them. But that doesn't mean you're going to go to the next level. It won't be truth to you. The next level will be truth to you. You know what I'm saying? So truth is one of those, because it's based on human consciousness, there's different levels to truth. That's my opinion.
Well, they have to define what is truth. You know, when Jesus went before Pontius Pilate, and Jesus says, I only look for the truth, and Pilate said, you know, what the heck is the truth? He said, the truth is nothing but more than a changing law of who's in power. And he says, you know, look at my truth. So they're the same as yours. So some people view what is called truth differently, you know.
Right.
So
see, definitions matter. Right.
Human beings
right.
learning, you know, we don't know what the actual truth is to everything. I mean, we're learning and we're stumbling, moving along.
Right.
And we go in a lot of directions that are wrong. But, you know, that's part of learning. When you go down a path that's wrong and you know it's wrong and you turn around and walk back down the path to get back on the main road to find
exactly.
the right path. But you
exactly.
never go down that path again. You see, that you've
right.
been down. Well, if you go
right.
back down that path again, you're not too smart, are you? I mean, you
right.
know. So, you know, you continue to move forward. I mean, you know, and in time, somewhere along the line, you know, when you're at the end of your journey, you discover what the truth is.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I believe that, you know, human beings are some of them are on the point of ascension. And ascension means, you know, not the end of the journey, but it's the beginning of the journey on the trail.
Mm.
Not the end. We're in the waiting area, the prep point right now.
But do you believe it's the end of being physical?
I believe it's the end of being physical as we know physical. But, you know,
okay.
there are many different states of physical humans in
that's
you know,
true.
Different planes.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, I don't think that, you know, our bodies will be plagued by, you know, the things we have now, you know,
right.
like backaches and so on. They'll be more enlightened and less influenced by disease and so on because they'll be more ascended and more resistant.
Right.
I believe that much of our disease anyway comes from our environment and from the mentality of the individual.
I agree totally.
Yeah,
yep.
So, you know, but ascension is the beginning of the journey on the path, not the end. Right now we're in the waiting room waiting, you know, to get the nerve or get the knowledge to or get the plan to get on that path.
Right.
This is why...
Well, remember what we said earlier... Courage and stupidity are a fine line.
Well, they are to a certain degree. I mean, you know, I mean, if I mean, courage and stupidity are a fine line.
Are related. They are in this dimension. From this point of awareness, I mean.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like you see these people that are doing these stunts that are unbelievable. That's not courage. That's stupidity. But when
right.
someone, for example, lowers themselves into a well to save a child. That's bravery.
Right.
That's courage.
Yeah.
But somebody who rides their bike, you know, into a herd of, you know, running buffalo or something, you know, these jackass things, that's stupid.
Oh, I don't even watch that show. God.
That's stupid.
Yeah, that's not what I meant either. I'm talking, it's almost like, you know, a friend of mine, Daniel, says, you'll always know the pioneers because of the arrows in their back. You know, at some point, you know, like you, you know, as a scientist, you're breaking free from the mold of science being only about the five senses, you know, into the more quasi-quantum area. So, you know, somebody's got to do, quote-unquote, something that might appear stupid, but it's really just courageous in the sense of just willing to explore something that, you know, has been... Because remember... You know, a couple hundred years ago, the Earth was flat. You know, clearly science evolves as consciousness evolves, right?
Yeah, well, you know, during when the Europeans thought the Earth was flat, the Greeks were telling them that the Earth was round for a very, very long time before that. They just didn't want to believe them.
Well, so, and all you have to do is look at the mystics who have also been telling everybody that, you know, the kingdom of God is within. It's not, there's not, heaven isn't a place on earth or a place in the heavens. Heaven is a state of being. It's a frequency. So it's kind of similar.
Yeah, well, it also depends upon the state of mind of the individual, I guess, and you know, and what they're going through. I believe also that, you know, a lot of people, a lot of good people are, you know, totally changed by their environment. I mean, there are children who grow up that, you know, are grown in high crime areas that become criminals because, you know, they do it to survive and so on and so on. And a lot of them break free of that when they get older. But unfortunately, planet Earth is not a very nice place to look for spiritual development at this particular point in time because of all the anxiety that's being created. I mean, I drive in the morning down to work, and I can just feel, you know, the anxiety from people on the road and stuff. Everybody's rushing and everything just to get to their jobs, and nobody. And I said, what are these people rushing for? What's going on here? Why are they driving so fast? Don't they know they're going to work?
It's an interesting paradox there. Listen, love, we are out of time. I so appreciate you and your stories and your whole perspective. I just enjoy spending time with you. And I thank you. Anything coming up for you that you want to share? Well, you shared the books. Any talks or any...
Yeah,
I'm
speaking at the Silas Bronson Library in Waterbury in October 23rd at 11 o'clock in the morning in Waterbury, Connecticut. It's a free lecture. I'm doing it for the UFO Network. Okay.
And actually, if you send me that, I'll put that up on the episode page. If you send me the information of, like, the store or whatever it is, I can edit it into the episode page, so if people want to hear, because I know a lot of people often ask me about you, and they would like to meet you. So send me that information in an email, and I'll put it up in the episode page.
Okay.
All right. Thank you so much for being here, and, well, you know, happy travels through paranormal land.
Bye-bye. Right now I'm going to bed just because I got to wake up.
Now that is the most paranormal you can go to. All right. I love you, Phil. Thanks for being here tonight. Thank you, everybody. I will see you guys or talk to you guys next week. Have an amazing week. Bye now.